Hello everyone, Pastor Tim here. Today I will be doing lesson number two on the book of Revelation. Last week I gave a brief introduction. For those of you who are new to this ministry, I have throughout the past as I've taught through books of the Bible, the New Testament, I have translated the book from the original Greek into English. Primarily it's been for my own study and benefit because there's so much that you can see in the Greek text, which is far richer than the English. And so I make that available as I begin a series of lessons on a particular book of the Bible. I make that available for download in PDF format. I will be following my own translation of the book in these lessons, and I would like for you all to follow along using that. So to get a copy of that in hard copy, which is probably your best bet, just go to our website, which is www.fourwindsfellowships.net. Now, it's the number four, not the word four spelled out, right? So it's www.fourwindsfellowships.net. When you get there, just click on the link that says LGV, that stands for the Last Generation Version. And all the books of the New Testament that I have completed are listed there, and you can click on any one of them and download them as a PDF and save it on your computer or print it out and use it as you study along with us. All right. Now, I also encourage you to have whatever other version of the New Testament that you use, have that handy as well, because from time to time I'll be pointing out just subtle differences in nuance between my translation and other English translations. And also, my translation contains a large number of commentary notes and cross-references and things like that, and footnotes at the bottom that will be very helpful for you. The translation contains more information in some cases than I'll actually be giving in the class. So if you want maximum amount of information that I can provide you on these lessons, then you'll need to do that. All right. Okay. Secondly, I mentioned last time that the book of Revelation contains many symbols or allegories or metaphors, and that these are drawn directly out of the Old Testament prophets. The pictures that we see in Daniel, where he paints, you know, these pictures of these different beasts that represent different kingdoms and things of that nature. But not only those beasts or animals, but many other components in the book of Revelation are drawn out of either the exact language from the Old Testament prophets or allusions to the specific prophecies in the Old Testament. And that if you don't understand the prophecies as they appear in the Old Testament, and many of those prophecies were concerning current events at that time. So in other words, they were fulfilled at the time of the prophet or shortly after the prophet. If you don't see how that those symbols were fulfilled in historical situations, so that you have a literal sequence of events in history that is the fulfillment of the symbols, then you're not going to be able to have the real key to understanding the book of Revelation. Revelation is filled with these symbols, and understanding how they have been used historically is absolutely critical to understanding the book of Revelation. Also, what a lot of people don't realize is that the symbolism that's used in prophecy and in Revelation did not just originate with the prophets in the Old Testament. That is, it was symbolism that has been handed down by God from the very beginning. Now, some of you know that several years ago, I wrote a book called Mystery of the Maseroth. I have a copy here. I'm going to do a shameless plug for my book. What this book does is it traces historically the development of what's called the zodiac. In the Bible, it's referred to as the Maseroth in the book of Job. And the Bible actually, the pictures that are in what is referred to as the zodiac, zodiac in Greek, by the way, simply means circle of life. And it's talking about the circle of the constellations in the zodiac. But all 12 of those symbols have a very important meaning. And what this book shows is that the symbols originally told a story in order as the sun passes through all the different constellations, the 12 constellations of the zodiac, that it tells a story in pictures. And that story is the story of God's redemption of the creation. And the symbols that are in that zodiac are the symbols, the same symbols that are found in the prophets, that are found in the book of Revelation. For example, in Revelation, we have Christ portrayed as both a lamb and a lion. He's called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah in chapter 5, I believe it is, of Revelation, or 6 of Revelation. And he appears as a lamb as though it had been slain. Well, these are two of the constellations. That's the constellation Aries, which is the lamb, and Leo, which is the lion. The woman that's portrayed in the sky in Revelation chapter 12 is Virgo. It's a constellation Virgo. And if you don't understand that, you're going to miss the importance of what's revealed to us in Revelation chapter 12 with regard to the woman who was about to give birth to the man-child. All right, now, this kind of symbolism is consistent. It's consistent in the Masoreth, it's consistent in the prophets, it's consistent in the book of Revelation. All right, the problem with most people today is they just look at the book of Revelation and they come at it with very little understanding of the Old Testament prophets, and usually having a wrong view of eschatology, what God has been doing since Genesis, and what his plan is, and then they try to impose their own modern ideas onto the book of Revelation. They come up with all kinds of wacky ideas and doctrines, and we want to avoid doing that. And so what you're going to see in this class as I go through these lessons is that I will constantly be going back to the Old Testament and showing you where the language that's being used is being drawn out of the Old Testament scriptures. All right, so anyway, well, let's get started in chapter 1 of Revelation. I'm going to read verses 1 through 3 from my translation, the Last Generation version of the book of Revelation. All right, here we go. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants the things which must occur suddenly, and God communicated it, having sent it by his messenger to his servant John, who reported the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ as much as he perceived. The reader and the listeners to the sayings of this prophecy are privileged, also those who heed the things written in it, because the appointed time is ready. All right, now what we're going to do is we're going to break this down into clauses and draw some really important information out of these first three verses. The most important clause probably in the entire three verses is the very first clause, which is the revelation of Jesus Christ. And as I mentioned last time, this book is not only about Jesus being revealed to the world in his second coming, that is indeed the revelation, that is his being revealed to the world of Jesus Christ, but it's also the revelation of Jesus Christ throughout the entire book of Revelation. That is the unfolding of the seals and the trumpet judgments and the vial judgments. Who is this lamb that's seated beside the Father on his throne, who is worthy to open the seals of this scroll and all that. And there is a great deal of information in the book of Revelation that tells us who Jesus actually is. So when it says the revelation of Jesus Christ, it's not only talking about him showing up at his second coming. It's talking about the fact that in this book, God is giving to us believers the clearest picture in the Bible, really. It's summarizing Jesus in all of his glory as he is going to be at his second coming And notice it says that he, that God gave to him, that is to Jesus Christ, to show his servants the things which must occur suddenly. God gave it to Jesus Christ. That's what it says. Look at it again. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him. Him refers back to Jesus. To show to his servants the things which must occur suddenly. Now, what that's saying essentially is that the contents of this book, the entire contents of this book, is something that God himself, the Father, devised and put this together as a means of communication to be given to his servants. Now, how did he deliver it? And this is one of the important questions that we have to always keep in mind in the book of Revelation, because what we will see throughout the book is that the message generally originates with the Father, but it is passed on through his Son, as it says clearly here, that Jesus Christ is the one that God gave this revelation to be delivered to John and to the seven churches, and then of course dispersed out to us as well in the New Testament. So there is a throughout the book of Revelation, there is sort of this, you might call it a pecking order. All right, there's this, the Father is the originator of all things. The Son is his special agent, messenger, whom he then entrusts this with to be delivered to the seven churches. And then we'll see later in Revelation that Jesus himself also uses messengers to point out certain aspects of this revelation to John, that is angels. Right now, I want to talk a little bit about this word messenger, because it's a critical word, and because so many people misunderstand it, there's all kinds of wrong doctrines about Christ and so forth. All right, look at verse. Let's read verse one again. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants the things which must occur suddenly, and God communicated it, having sent it by his messenger. Notice that, his messenger, that is God's messenger, to his servant John. Now, who is the recipient of the message in this verse? It's very clear that it is John. John is the first human recipient of the contents of the book of Revelation, right? I think everyone would agree that that's very plain in verse one. The one between the Father and the Son that delivered the message to John is referred to here as his messenger, that is God's messenger. Now, some people might look at that and say, well, okay, in my translation, I capitalize that messenger because it's pointing to Christ. Some people might say, well, maybe it means Jesus sent a messenger of Jesus to John. Now, which of those is correct? Well, the answer to that is very clear, because all you have to do is continue reading through chapter one and see who is it that appeared to John. Who is it that spoke directly to John, right? And that's very clear. Look at, flip over to verse 12. He says, in the rest of chapter one, John sees this vision. This is how it starts. He sees this this vision of the seven lampstands, and he sees one like the Son of Man. He's referred to as the Son of Man. Verse 12, it says, and I turned to see the voice that spoke to me, and upon turning, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of the seven lampstands, I saw one like the Son of Man, having been clothed with a foot-length robe and fastened about the chest with a golden band, and so forth. So the one who appeared to John, who spoke to John, is referred to as having the appearance of a Son of Man. All right, now that's a term that's used of Christ repeatedly in the Gospels. Also, when you get down to verse 17, the Son of Man speaks to John directly, and here's what he says. Verse 17 says, and when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead, and he placed his right hand on me, saying to me, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. Now, this is the critical part. I am he who lives and became dead. And look, I am alive unto the ages of the ages. Amen. And I hold the keys of the grave and of death. Write the things that you saw and what is and what is to come afterwards, and so forth. And it goes on to begin to explain some of the elements in the vision that John just saw. So the point is, the point that I want to make and I want to drive home, and this is a very critical point, is that in verse 1, where it says his messenger, that is God's messenger, that the messenger is Christ himself, because it clearly says who the recipient was. It says he communicated it, having sent it by his messenger to his servant John. So John was the recipient, and as we see farther down in the chapter, John receives the message directly from Jesus Christ, not from an intermediary between Christ and John. That is, Jesus did not send a representative to appear to John. Jesus himself appeared to John. Now, again, this doesn't mean that Jesus left heaven and came down to earth, because this is a vision, all right? It's not, if somebody else was sitting next to John, they wouldn't have seen any of this. John is able to see a vision that is being produced for his benefit so that Christ can speak to him from heaven, from the right hand of the Father, all right? So let's talk more about this term messenger. Now, if you compare it to your other Bibles, you'll see that it's translated as angel. That is his angel. And so when people read that, they immediately think that the one who appeared to John was an angel. But he was not an angel in the sense that we think of the term. And here's why. The Greek word here is angelos. Angelos was a common Greek word, as common as the word messenger is in English. Angelos was the common Greek word for a messenger. If you sent your the mail, you sent him a letter or whatever, the mailman is a angelos, a messenger delivering a message. The same word is used of humans that were sent with messages. But because the Bible also uses the same word with regard to heavenly messengers, unfortunately, rather than translating this word correctly, in our English Bible, they have instead transliterated it. Now, what's the difference between translate and transliterate? Translate means you convey the meaning of the word in the target language. Transliterate means you only convey the sound of the word, how it sounds to the ear. You convey that in the target language. Well, the problem with transliterating instead of translating is that you lose the meaning of the word in the text. And it can take on an entirely new meaning in the target language, because in the target language, you don't have that word being used in ordinary speech. But see, in Greek, in which this was written, angelos was a common word. So it's wrong to translate it as angel, because in English, an angel is much more specific. In English, angel means a heavenly being, right? That's not physical, flesh, not human, like we are. And we don't use the word angel in English to refer to the mailman. But in Greek, it's not that way, all right? So we have to be careful that we don't misunderstand that word messenger, because it's an absolutely critical word. All right, now the reason that this is critical is because there is a mysterious figure that shows up all through the Torah, the books of Moses. And this figure is called in our English Bibles the angel of the Lord, or the angel of God. And it's in the Greek version of the Old Testament, it's the same word, angelos. Now, the angel of the Lord, or the angel of God, a lot of people don't know much about him. And a lot of Christians think that the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament is just an angel, in the way we think of angels, because of the use of the word angel in English. But literally, if you translate the Old Testament literally, whether it's from the Hebrew text or whether it's from the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, either way, if you translate it correctly, and if you translate the term itself and don't transliterate it instead, if you translate it, it literally says the messenger of the Lord. You will also see, as you look at all the places in the Old Testament where this phrase is used, that it's usually capitalized. And the reason it's capitalized is because it's a reference to the Son of God. Now, this messenger, the messenger of the Lord, is the one who has always appeared to mankind. In John chapter 1, verse 18, John writes, "For no one has seen God at any time." At any time is an exclusive statement. No one has ever, ever seen God. The only begotten Son, who's in the bosom of the Father, he is the one who has made him known or declared him. That's what John 1:18 says. There, Jesus himself said that no one has seen God except himself. And he, of course, he's talking about humans. The Apostle Paul repeatedly referred to God as being invisible, whom no man can see or has seen. That's in I believe 2 Timothy. So what we have is that the Father is an invisible God. He has never been seen by mortal men. And yet we have in the Old Testament all these passages of Scripture where it says that God or the Lord, Jehovah, appeared to so-and-so. I think one of the best passages there, and I love to use this passage to refute Jehovah's Witnesses, because it says there that Jehovah appeared to Abraham while he sat in his tent door. And there's this conversation between these three, it calls them men, who showed up at Abraham's tent and conversed with Abraham, and you know, Sarah prepared a lunch for them. They ate. Two of them then went on their way to Sodom to get Lot out of Sodom. And then Abraham, it says, he stood before Jehovah, and he negotiated with Jehovah there about who would be spared regarding, how many just persons in Sodom would he spare the city for, and so forth. So we have this Jehovah in the form of man talking face to face with Abraham. Well, in Genesis chapter 22, actually, let's go there, because I want to spend a little more time on this. Go to Genesis 22. This is the story of Abraham being, his faith being tested when he was to offer up his son Isaac. Let's start in verse 11. You guys know the story, so we don't need to go over all of that. But I want you to pay attention to the language that's used here in Genesis. Genesis 22, verse 11. Well, let's go to verse 10. "And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord," and that's, you'll see it's capitalized in your translation. Again, literally, it's the messenger of the Lord. Lord is in all caps. So that's the, in Hebrew, that is Yahweh or Jehovah. That's his proper name. So the messenger of Jehovah called to him from heaven and said, now does it say that Jehovah called to him from heaven? No, it says the messenger of Jehovah called to him from heaven. So the voice that Abraham heard was not the voice of Jehovah himself. It was the voice of an intermediary. It was the voice of an agent of Jehovah. It says the messenger of Jehovah called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." So he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Now note the word me. Me is a first person pronoun. Abraham did not withhold his son from me. And who is the me? Again, it's the angel or the messenger of the Lord who's speaking. Abraham did not withhold his son from the messenger of the Lord. Well, then who was it that gave Abraham the command? Back in verse 1, it says, it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said to him, here I am. Then he said, take now your son, your only son whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you, and so forth. And Abraham obeys. Well, who is it that spoke to Abraham? It says that God did here. But here, it's clearly the messenger of God is clearly saying, you have not withheld your son from me. Now, what this implies is that the one who spoke to Abraham in the first place and told him to go do this was the Lord. Now, let's continue reading. Then Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide, or Jehovah Jireh. As it is said to this day, quote, in the mountain of the Lord it shall be provided. Notice the future tense there. It shall be provided. What is it that shall be provided? A substitute lamb. That's what shall be provided. Anyway, look at verse 15. Then the messenger of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, quote, by myself I have sworn, says Jehovah, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you, your descendants, as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is in the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Now notice here, it says, when the messenger of the Lord speaks to Abraham the second time, it says, he said, by myself I have sworn, says Jehovah. Now he is saying that these words, the swearing of an oath, that these words he is delivering from his father, from God, that is from Jehovah himself. Right? Look at it again. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time and said, by myself I have sworn, says Jehovah. Now, if it didn't say, says Jehovah, then we would assume that the words were originating from the messenger of Jehovah. But because it says Jehovah, it's clear that the words are originating from Jehovah and they're being delivered by the messenger of the Lord. He's simply quoting Jehovah to Abraham. Because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and so forth. So, and then again, at the end, it says, because you have obeyed my voice, that is Jehovah's voice. So what all this means, if you interpret it without any shenanigans, what all this means is that Jehovah was interacting with Abraham by means of a mediator, by means of a messenger. And the messenger had the authority to speak these words to Abraham. Now, if you go over to Exodus chapter 23, actually, I'm going to read this out of the Greek version, the Septuagint, an English translation of that. In Exodus chapter 23, go down to verse 20. Now, this is later after God called Moses and appointed him to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. But he says here, behold, these are the words of God. He says, behold, I send my angel or messenger before your face to bring you in the way and to bring you into the land I prepared for you. Listen to him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. For or because my name is in him. Now, what does that mean? My name is in him. Well, what that means is that this messenger of Jehovah, whom God the Father had sent to earth to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt and to bring them through the wilderness and to bring them into the promised land, he's the one who's doing it, the messenger of Jehovah, not Jehovah himself. But whenever the messenger of Jehovah does something, because he's the authorized agent for Jehovah, what the messenger of Jehovah does, Jehovah is said to have done. Or does that make sense? We would do the same thing. We can do the same thing now. If a king sends an ambassador to go and do something in his name in another country, to make a deal or do something in another country, and that ambassador carries that out, it is proper to say that the king made this deal, because he simply is using a messenger to make the deal, but the messenger has the full authority of the king to act on his behalf. Verse 22, but if you will indeed obey my voice and do all I command you and keep my covenant, you shall be a special people above all nations, for the whole earth is mine. And you shall be a royal priesthood, a holy nation. You shall speak these words to the children of Israel, and if you shall indeed obey my voice and do all I tell you, I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries, because my angel or my messenger will go before you and bring you to the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Girgazites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. Now, God is doing all these things with the nation of Israel through a mediator. The Father himself, Jehovah himself, does not come down to earth to do these things. He is sending his messenger to do them. And the important part in this particular statement is he says, my name is in him. My name is in him. My name, Jehovah, is in him. And this is why back in Exodus, the Exodus chapter 3, I'm not going to go there right now, but in Exodus 3, where we have the story of God appearing to Moses in the burning bush, it specifically says that the angel of the Lord, or the messenger of the Lord, appeared to Moses in the burning bush. And what does he say? He says, I am the God of your father Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Wow. And then Moses has to take his sandals off because he's standing on holy ground. Well, this messenger of the Lord keeps referring to himself, I, as Jehovah. And the reason he does that is because, as it says here in this other passage, my name is in him. He has the authority to speak for me and to use my name. Therefore, he can use first person pronouns as though he was Jehovah himself when he speaks, because he is my authorized agent to speak on my behalf. All right. Now, what's interesting about this is we see this all through the books of Moses, and we also see it occasionally in other places as well. For example, when the messenger or angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon's, I believe it was Gideon's parents, or to Gideon, there he speaks in the first person as Jehovah himself. And we see this repeatedly. So now when we come to the book of Revelation and we see this exact same pattern taking place, where it says that God gave to him, that is to Jesus Christ, to show his servants the things which must occur suddenly, and God communicated it, having sent it by his messenger, it is clearly referring to Jesus Christ as God's angel, God's messenger. All right, Jesus Christ is God's messenger. Now, another thing we find in the Old Testament scriptures repeatedly is that the messenger of the Lord that is mentioned in the Old Testament is said to be or to become the Messiah. Those people who do not believe in the pre-existence of Christ, they believe that Jesus was just a man. He was born. He began to exist at the time he was born as a human being, have completely missed the mark as to who Jesus Christ really is. He is the messenger of Jehovah, the one whose name was in him, the one whom the Father sent all throughout the Old Testament to deliver his words, to make the covenant with Abraham, to make the covenant with Moses. This is the one who became human and appeared in the flesh. Now, we know this to be the case for a couple of reasons. I'm going to give you two brief ones. if you go, well, I'm going to be reading from the Greek version of the Old Testament. In Isaiah, you all are familiar with Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. That's the famous prophecy about the birth of Christ. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and so forth. I'm going to read it to you from the Greek version, an English translation of the Greek version, referred to as the Septuagint. The Greek version of the Old Testament was translated from the Hebrew about 200 to 300 years before Christ was born. So the Jews in the synagogues had the Septuagint in Greek, and they used it in their ordinary readings. Throughout all of the Roman Empire, in the synagogues, it was the Septuagint that was being read in the synagogues. And so when the apostles wrote the New Testament books, the quotations that they draw out of the Old Testament are almost always from the Septuagint version. And there are times when there's a difference between the Septuagint and our modern Hebrew, and they follow the Septuagint readings, especially in those places that talk about Christ. They follow the Septuagint. You see that in Hebrews. Paul always quotes the Septuagint, and there are passages that he quotes from the Septuagint that actually don't appear anything like that in the Hebrew text. And Paul can't even make his point from the Hebrew text, but he makes his point from the Septuagint. So it's a valuable resource, and you should be familiar with it. But anyway, here's that famous prophecy about the birth of Christ in Isaiah chapter 9, 6 and 7. Here's what it says from the Greek version. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. His name will be called the Angel of Great Counsel, or the Messenger of Great Counsel. For I will bring peace upon their rulers, peace and health by him. Great shall be his government, and of his peace there will be no end. His peace shall be upon the throne of David, and over his kingdom, to order and establish it with righteousness and judgment. From that time forward, and unto ages of ages, the zeal of the Lord of hosts shall perform this. So, in that famous passage in Isaiah, there's subtle differences in this terminology that's found here. And note that his name is called the Angel of Great Counsel, the Messenger of Great Counsel. Now, go to Malachi, Book of Malachi. Remember, that's a prophecy about the birth of Christ and who he is. Who is he? He's the Messenger of Great Counsel. Now, any Jew reading that would immediately associate that with the Messenger of the Lord. That's all throughout the Old Testament. But there's an even clearer passage in Malachi chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. Now, if you're reading this from most translations, messenger, the first messenger there is not capitalized, and that's because it's referring to John the Baptist. In fact, this passage is quoted in the Gospels and applied to John the Baptist. So we know that the messenger who is sent to prepare the way is John the Baptist. This is one of those cases where the word messenger or angel, angelos, is being used of a human being. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant. And here the word messenger is capitalized, or angel, it's the same word, right? The messenger of the covenant, whom you desire. Now, who is the one that Israel desired? Obviously, it's the Messiah. So he's calling the Messiah here the messenger of the covenant. Now, why is the Messiah called the messenger of the covenant? Well, the reason is very simple. It's because he's the one who delivered the covenants to Abraham, as we read in Genesis 22. He's the one who delivered the Mount Sinai covenant to Moses in the burning bush. And in case you didn't know this, the messenger of the Lord is also the one who appeared at the top of Mount Sinai and gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. Now, this is stated a couple of times in the Greek version of the Old Testament, but It's mentioned also in the New Testament, and so I wanted to confirm that by showing that to you. Go to Acts chapter 7. This is Acts chapter 7 was Stephen's defense while just before he was stoned to death when they rejected his counsel. But this is what Stephen had to say. He gives a history of how Israel has rejected God's sending messages to them. Verse 30, he says, "And when the 40 years had passed, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush." Now, again, that's the messenger of the Lord. Same exact language that we're seeing in Revelation chapter 1. In a bush in the wilderness in Mount Sinai. "When Moses saw it, he marveled at the great sight. And as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him," and again, it's the messenger of the Lord, "saying," quote, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." And Moses trembled and dared not look. Then the Lord said to him, and again, it's the messenger of the Lord, but he's delivering the message for the Lord as his trusted agent, his personal messenger. He says, "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their groaning and have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, 'Who made you to be a ruler and a judge?' is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer." Now notice this, "by the hand of the angel who appeared in the bush." So it says God sent Moses to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel or the messenger who appeared to him in the bush. And that is the Son of God who appeared to him in the bush. Let's keep reading. "He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren.'" That is, from among the Israelites. "This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness." That is, this Moses is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with, now notice this, the angel or the messenger who spoke to him on Mount Sinai and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us. Now, it's very clear from Stephen's statement here that he understood what the Greek version of the Old Testament witnesses to. That is, when God appeared on Mount Sinai and gave the Ten Commandments to Moses, that it was not Jehovah himself personally who came down on Mount Sinai. It was the messenger of Jehovah who came down on Mount Sinai. And that messenger of Jehovah is the one that Isaiah says is going to be born as a little child. In Isaiah 9, 6, and 7, his name is the messenger of great counsel. And Malachi chapter 3, verse 1 says that the Lord is going to come, that John the Baptist is going to announce his coming. And then it says, "The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant," the one who brought, the one who has confirmed all of God's covenants to mankind, to Abraham, to Moses, and he can also, in the flesh, confirm the new covenant with his disciples. He is the messenger of the covenant, the one who has always interacted with humanity from the beginning of time. All right, now, I only have a few minutes left, so let's try to wrap up verses 1 through 3. I'm going to read verses 1 through 3 again of Revelation chapter 1 from my translation. "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants the things which must occur suddenly. And God communicated it, having sent it by his messenger to his servant John." And again, Jesus is the one who appeared to John, so Jesus is the messenger of the Lord, "who reported the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ as much as he perceived." Now notice it says that John reported the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. That is Jesus Christ's own testimony to John. That's what it's saying. So again, it's clearly identifying the one who appeared to John as Jesus Christ. That's my timer. That's my timer telling me my time's up. Anyway, it's clearly stating in verse 1 and 2 that Jesus Christ is the messenger of God. There's just no way of getting around that statement. All right, that's what I want you to understand. Notice also it says, as much as he perceived, that is, as much as John perceived. John's point in that statement is simply saying, look, I'm just reporting what was delivered to me. I'm not trying to interpret all the symbols or anything like that. Everything, as I understood it, as it was given to me, and as I understood it, this is what I'm reporting to you. All right, so it's unfiltered. That's the point he's making. All that is written in the book of Revelation, all of it was delivered by Jesus Christ to John, and all of it was unfiltered by John. He simply faithfully wrote it all down, all that he was told, all that he saw, and so forth. All right. And the reader and listeners to the sayings of this prophecy are privileged, also those who heed the things written in it, because the appointed time is ready. Now, next time, I'm going to talk about two clauses in these first three verses where it says the things must occur suddenly. I think some translations say quickly. I want to talk about what does that mean. And also, it says the appointed time is ready. Some translations say the time is at hand. I want to talk about what do those two phrases mean. They are used repeatedly in the book of Revelation with regard to all the events that are described. So does that mean, some people say that means, well, then the tribulation must have started, you know, back in the time of the apostles, because, you know, they're saying that it was, you know, imminent or something like that. That's not what those clauses are saying. All right, so we'll talk about that a little bit next time. All right, well, God bless you all, and I hope you continue in this series of lessons.